There's a cafe outside the entrance downstairs which provides refreshments for those who require them. Now, this is the first of the further hearing sessions, so I'd like to start, if I may, by giving a brief outline of the examination process so far. And as part of that, the North Essex authorities also want to make some introductory remarks. So the examination began in October 2017 when the Section 1 plan was submitted for examination by Braintree District Council, Colchester Borough Council and Tendring District Council, collectively known as the North Essex Authorities. I held hearing sessions in January and May 2018, and in June 2018 I wrote two letters to the North Essex Authorities setting out my findings at that stage. In my letters, I found that the authorities had met the duty to cooperate in preparing the plan, and that based on the evidence then before me, the housing requirement figures in the plan reflected the objectively assessed need for housing. However, I found that the evidence provided to support the garden community proposals in the submitted plan were lacking in a number of respects. In response to my findings, the North Essex authorities decided to prepare further evidence in order to demonstrate that the plan is sound. And at this point, I'd like to invite the authorities to explain the work they've undertaken in that respect.
Thank you, sir. We've met before, but my name's Ian Vipond, and I come from Colchester Borough Council and represent North Essex authorities as one of the directors working for one of those authorities. First, can I welcome you back to North Essex? It seems only yesterday, dare I say, but welcome back. And can I welcome back all of the participants who are joining us for these sessions and have been with us on this journey. If I could briefly add to your housekeeping announcements, we've done the fire. I think people will find toilets to the left or the right on this corridor as well. There is, should it be needed or if people wish to use it, an overflow room immediately next door, out of these doors on the right, which has audio and video feed. Just to briefly explain the microphones. The microphones are important to feed the audio feed, so if they could be used. They also feed a hearing loop in this room only. So again, it would be useful if everybody can use the microphones. If you press the speaker button and you get a red light, it means you alive and able to speak. If you get a green flashing light, that indicates you're next in line, so to speak. And if you get a solid green light, you're in the queue. Hopefully that will become self-evident as we go through the sessions. At all times, the inspector has the ability to override all of the microphones. There will be an audio recording, and that will go on to the main local plan site, which is the Braintree local plan website. Although, as I say, there is a video feed to next door, there is no video recording of these sessions. Sir, you will recognise some of the participants from the North Essex authorities from your last visit. It is perhaps worth me just introducing Rob Williams, our counsel, who will appear with us on certain days, although we will also be accompanied by Michael Bedford QC, who is not with us today. So you identified that you wrote to us on the 8th of June 2018 following a series of hearing sessions outlining your conclusions on further steps that would be necessary in order for Section 1 plan to be made sound and legally compliant. You subsequently wrote on the 27th of June and the 2nd of August of that year to clarify some specific matters. You were right in your concluding remarks that your conclusions came as a disappointment to the NEAs. Clearly, we would like to be in a position now to have an adopted local plan in place in the three districts. However, we know that we have a level of ambition for high-quality, strategic-scale development which continues beyond the proposed local plan period. We concur with your assessment that the nature of our proposals requires adequate evidence that they are deliverable and viable, and appropriate care in assessing the implications of those proposals on North Essex. We are seeking to set a long-term strategy which, subject to appropriate reviews, will set a path for development in North Essex for many years to come. We believe that 2 years on from the start of the first round of the local plan examination sessions, that we can now demonstrate the necessary evidence base to justify our strategic approach. The councils gave your findings and advice on options for the way forward significant consideration before writing to you with their response on the 19th of October 2018, setting out how they wish to take forward the examination of the strategic Section 1 plan. It could be said that the councils have not taken the easy option, with some believing that was set out in your Option 1. However, the councils absolutely believe that the opportunity Garden Communities presents is not one that should be missed, nor one that should be kicked into the long grass, perhaps never to reappear, because they are just too difficult. The MPPF tells us that local plans are the key to delivering sustainable development that reflects the vision and aspiration of local communities. The councils believe that the strategy they have put forward, at the heart of which are the garden communities, is aspirational but realistic and will deliver sustainable development for their areas. Sir, despite your earlier conclusions, we were grateful for your detailed considerations. These have been very useful in shaping the work that has been undertaken in the intervening period. A number of specific issues have been the subject of further work, but importantly, I would note the following. Firstly, we have taken your advice and put back the delivery timescales of the bigger proposed garden community at Colchester Braintree Borders, which is now expected to start delivery in the final 5-year period of the plan. In addition, greater certainty around the strategic infrastructure requirements has been achieved in that a HIF allocation of government funding has been confirmed in principle for the A133-A120 link road to the east of Colchester, together with the first phase delivery of the RTS. A further HIF bid outcome is awaited for the rerouting of the A12 to the west of Colchester, and Highways England have consulted on those route options. On the matter of viability, a substantial body of additional evidence has been collected and tested. We know the examination will involve a viability technical seminar as well as the actual examination session. We have revisited the basics of the viability work in light of your concerns around certain specific assumptions not being dealt with adequately in the previous body of evidence. Sir, I would finally come to your earlier conclusions that the SA work, as then undertaken by the NEAs, had a number of shortcomings and fell short of demonstrating that the chosen strategy was the most appropriate one. The NEAs have commissioned LUC to undertake additional SA work and closely kept to the suggestions you yourself made on how the shortcomings could be rectified. That work itself was subject to engagement with a number of parties and is the subject matter of one of the days in these sessions. So we believe the evidence is convincing that the strategy embodied in Section 1 is both sound and deliverable. The evidence now before you does, we believe, give sufficient clarity to enable you to agree the principle of the proposed garden communities is sound. The adoption of these local plans will allow the significant work in detail to progress and momentum to build around the delivery of these communities. The NEAs have never shrunken from their high aspirations to see amazing places built for future generations. We now confidently recommend our strategy to you. We consider it to be the most appropriate long-term strategy for North Essex. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vipon. Thank you very much. The further evidence that Mr. Vipond has just outlined was the subject, as you'll all be aware, of a technical consultation last August and September. And the primary focus of these further hearing sessions will be on that further evidence prepared by the North Essex authorities. But it's important to emphasise that this is not a new examination. I will take into account everything said at the previous hearing sessions and all the previous written submissions when I consider my conclusions and recommendations on the plan. There are three possible outcomes to the examination. First, that I find the Section 1 plan is sound and legally compliant as submitted and should be adopted. Second, that I find that the plan can be made sound and legally compliant and therefore capable of adoption if modifications are made to it. And before I would make that recommendation, the proposed modifications would be subject to full public consultation. And the third possible outcome is that I find that the plan could not be made sound and legally compliant, in which case the authorities would be invited to withdraw it. As at the original hearing sessions in 2018, I will need some time to reflect on what is said at the further hearing sessions, and so I expect to write to the North Essex authorities after the hearings have closed to set out my findings. So that concludes the general introduction to the further hearing sessions, and so we're now moving on to this morning's business, which is the Matter 1 hearing session concerning the Habitats Regulations Assessment of the plan. And I'll give a very brief further introduction to this session and invite the North Essex authorities to do the same. But before I do that, can I ask those sitting around the table please to introduce themselves? And when you do so, please turn your microphone on and speak directly towards the microphone itself so that people using the audio systems can hear you. Can I start on my left, please?
I'm Katie Schooler from Denton's, the external solicitors advising the North Essex authorities.
So, as Mr. Vipon said, I'm Robert Williams of Council, instructed by Denton's on behalf of the North Essex authorities.
David Green, Associate Director at LUC, an ecologist and co-author of the HRA.
Good morning, my name is Shelley Blackaby. I'm a Planning Policy Officer at Colchester Borough Council, representing the NEAs.
I'm Jane Black, representing the Wivenhoe Society.
Good morning, sir. I'm Dr. Chris Gibson, ecologist, with a long experience of working with the Habitats Directive and Regulations, initially with Natural England, from whom I retired after 31 years, some 4 years ago. I'm appearing on behalf of Wivenhoe Town Council.
It's Andrea Luxford-Vaughan on behalf of Wivenhoe Town Council. Martin Edwards of Council, on behalf of CAUSE.
Rosie Pearson, on behalf of CAUSE.
Stuart Patience, Spatial Planning Manager at Anglian Water.
Nicola Neal, Water Quality Planning Specialist, Environment Agency.
Andrew Martin, representing Cres Nicholson, RF West Limited, Livelands, and David Sherwood.
Thanks very much. If anyone has difficulty hearing at the back of the room, could you put your hand up as soon as it becomes a problem, so that I know that it is a problem and I can try and do something to sort it out. Thank you. Well, thank you all for attending today, and also thank you for your hearing statements and response statements addressing my original issues and questions that were circulated towards the end of last year. I've read them all, and I will expect everyone else around the table to have done the same. And I hope you all have the agenda for today's session, this morning's session, which was circulated last week. It sets out the questions that I would like to discuss today, having read your statements and responses. And essentially what the agenda does is move a step on from your statements and responses into the questions that arise from that, and that I would feel I would benefit from hearing discussion on today. What I don't need to do today is hear once again what you've already put in your written statements. Before we launch into the discussion, I believe the authorities want to make a short statement to set the scene.
Yes, as you kindly indicated in one of your guidance notes, the authorities would like to see that. In this case, Ms. Blackaby is going to undertake a short opening.
Thank you.
OEC, on behalf of the NEAs, prepared an updated Habitat Regulations Assessment, HRA, report, reference EB083. Which is compliant with the requirements of the Conservation of Habitats and Species Regulations 2017 and relevant legislation and case law, including relevant case law that's emerged following the previous hearings. As competent authorities, the NEAs are satisfied that the HRA demonstrates that the Section 1 plan, alone or in combination with other plans, would not adversely affect the integrity of the relevant European sites. The recommendations and mitigation requirements identified in the appropriate assessment have been incorporated into the Section 1 local plan. Further modifications are proposed, and these are set out in the updated Statements of Common Ground, that's SCG 001A with Natural England and SCG 002A with the Environment Agency and Anglian Water Services. Natural England are of the view that the HRA has reached the correct conclusion, and they are confident that the measures that are being put in place are sufficient and deliverable to ensure that the plan is compliant with the habitat regulations. Natural England has explained to the inspector that they're not attending today's hearing session as they prioritise attendance at local plan examinations where there are outstanding issues and matters which remain unresolved. Natural England have agreed a statement of common ground with the NEAs and are in agreement with the overall approach proposed by the NEAs, and they do not have any outstanding concerns. As the Nature Conservation Body for England, Natural England's judgment should be given considerable weight. The preparation and implementation of the Essex Coast Recreational Disturbance Avoidance and Mitigation Strategy, RAMS, is one of the key mitigation measures to mitigate likely significant effects from recreational disturbance in combination with other plans and projects. The Essex Coast RAMS was initiated by Natural England, who've been involved in the project by providing advice and guidance from the outset. The NEAs are active members of the RAMS steering group and have engaged positively with Natural England and other local authority partners to progress the RAMS, and with our development management teams to ensure that developer contributions are collected. Natural England signed off the RAMS strategy document prior to its completion and subsequent adoption by local authority partners. Natural England continue to be involved in the RAMS as a member of the RAMS steering group. All 12 local authority partners have adopted the Essex Coast RAMS strategy document, and consultation on the Essex Coast RAMS SPD commenced on Friday, the 10th of January. Mitigation strategies following the same approach as the Essex Coast RAMS have been considered and accepted as appropriate mitigation as part of other local plan examinations around the country. For example, Chelmsford City Council, who are a partner in the Essex Coast RAMS, received a letter from their local plan inspector in February 2019 stating that at this stage, I consider that the local plan is a plan which could be found sound, subject to main modifications. Chelmsford's local plan includes a RAMS policy and reference to the RAMS in site allocation policies where relevant. Other examples where the role of RAMS or a similar mitigation method has been accepted through local plan examinations are plentiful. For example, local plans of both of the New Forest District and National Park authorities, Breckland District Council, Plymouth and South West Devon Joint Local Plan, and North East Lincolnshire Local Plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blackerby. Thank you very much. Right, let's move on then to this morning's agenda. And just one procedural point before we go into that. Mr. Vipond mentioned the lights on the microphones. Now, I'm afraid that's going to be a bit too technical for me and possibly a bit difficult for me to see. So I'm going to revert to the tried and tested method of asking you to put your nameplates on their ends, please, if you want to speak on a particular question. That's much easier for me to see then, and I think that'll be the best way to do it. But of course, do turn your microphone on when it's your turn to speak. Right, so the first topic within today's agenda derives from my original question, whether the HRA, the Habitats Regulations Assessment carried out by LUC, should have taken account of the implications for European sites of development beyond 2033 proposed in the Section 1 plan. And as you'll see on the agenda, my comment on that is that in its introduction, the HRA doesn't appear to say explicitly whether or not it takes account of development beyond 2033. The NEAs correctly point out in their hearing statement that Section 2 of the HRA identifies the future capacities of the garden communities. But on the other hand, there are some paragraphs which I've identified there which appear to refer to impacts of development within the plan period only. So I'm still somewhat unclear, really, on whether this on the answer to my original question. And that's why I've set down question A to try and sort that out. And then question B, if it turns out that the HRA did not take account of the implications of development beyond 2033, how could this be rectified, if that is possible? So I think perhaps I'll ask LUC to address this question first, and then I'll take anybody else who wants to come in on it. So Mr. Green, I think it'll be.
Yes, thank you, sir. So notwithstanding that the view of Natural England and the North Essex authorities is that there wasn't a requirement to consider development beyond 2033.
Right, there wasn't.
Natural England's view is that there isn't a requirement to consider the development beyond 2033. However, LUC, as we always do, as part of a robust HRA approach, I can assure you that we did consider the full extent of the garden communities, and I can provide examples to demonstrate that. That was considered in line with a precautionary approach. We were cognizant of the... Whilst the HRA no doubt focused on the development period, the plan period to 2033, we had cognizance of the entirety of the garden communities. So, for example, the assessment of water... Looked at the integrated water management strategy. Within that, it's the complete build-out of the garden communities that has been considered and assessed and upon which our HRA conclusions are based. Off-site habitat, for example, when we were shown the tendering garden community, we weren't given subdivisions. We weren't given phases. We were given an area within which it would be focused, and therefore it stands to reason that we could only have assessed and viewed and looked at the entirety of the polygon within which housing would be delivered. And thirdly, there's recreation. And I think the key point here is that, you know, in our discussions with Natural England, in establishment of the RAMS approach, it was never the intention for that to just address the low number that would be coming forward, the relatively low number that would be coming forward within the plan period, but rather the full extent of the garden communities. Indeed, the whole purpose of the RAMS approach is to be strategic and to consider the wider growth. I note that the RAMS in particular runs to 2038, and I'm sure we'll come on to the whole future in perpetuity discussion later on. But I think, again, with regard to recreation and RAMS, it's important to recognise that the RAMS approach isn't tied to numbers. There's a very strong scientific evidence throughout the UK that recreational impacts are tend to be worse. How do I phrase this? Low numbers of unregulated activity can cause a lot more of an impact than relatively higher numbers of well-regulated and well-managed activity. And the purpose of the RAMS is to put those measures into place. I think the key with the RAMS is much has been said of the adequacy of the RAMS approach, and I would just like to reiterate that RAMS is not a new package. Whilst we don't have a 20-year record of empirical evidence to show that RAMS works, what we do need to recognise is that the RAMS approach is based on evidence of things that we do know. We do understand the ecology of the birds. We do understand the types of recreational activity that affect them. And that is why the RAMS is going to be an effective approach and is endorsed, in fact, initiated by Natural England, RSPB and the Wildlife Trusts. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Could we look briefly at the examples that I've set out on the agenda in the Habitats Regulation Assessment itself, the document itself? So the first extract I've identified is paragraphs 415 to 416. And this comes under the heading Impacts of Recreation in the RAMS document.
Yes.
So that is identifying the build out within the plan period, isn't it, at the three garden communities?
That's right, and actually the what's unfortunate is the in the plan period to 2033. And if I'm honest, there is an element of we regularly undertake HRA. I write HRAs every day, and if I'm honest, it was just a regular use of language. And I think I hold my hands up to say that actually the HRA probably does need to be updated to explicitly clarify certain aspects of this. But what I would emphasise crucially is that we have recognised the complete build out there under 4.15, so beyond the 2033.
Just If you turn to paragraph 650, the same... same situation applies there, doesn't it? At the end of the of that paragraph, it talks about the proposals within tendering Colchester Borders Garden Community within the plan period, rather than the whole build out.
Yeah, agreed.
So what you're saying to me is that I shouldn't take too much notice of what it says there, because you've
what I'm saying is there is some confusion in the HRA, and a lot of that is based on, if I'm honest, generic HRA wording where we regularly refer to within the plan period, and I think it needs clarifying. But what I can assure you, based on the examples I've just provided, is that the three issues where likely significant effects were identified, so loss of off-site habitat, recreational disturbance and water issues, the entirety of the garden communities were taken into account in the assessment.
Okay, thank you. Dr.
Gibson. Thank you very much, sir. Yes. I'll return to the point about the specific questions A and B shortly. But I think at the outset, I'd just like to draw your attention to a response to your initial question. One, should the HRA have taken account of implications beyond the plan period? And draw your attention to the very first paragraph, substantive paragraph under that response provided by LUC, which is that 1.1.1, the requirements of the Habitats Regulations are to assess the plan. And then it goes on to say the regulations do not require an assessment of short, medium, long-term impacts, or specifically an assessment of the future growth beyond the plan period. I would maintain that statement is wrong. I think it would be appropriate to say the requirements of the Habitats Regulations are to assess the plan alone and in combination with all of other relevant plans and projects, which is a phrase of which you are well aware. The temporal extension of one particular project into a new temporal phase is, in my view, a very relevant plan or project to be included in combination with the plan under consideration here. I am not aware of any situation in which the courts, either national or European, have been asked that specific question, whether temporal extension should be considered a relevant plan or project in combination. But equally, I am very well aware that the courts have always taken a very broad view of the ambit of the assessments, and that it would be wrong to assume that the temporal extension should not be treated as a part of the in combination scenario. And therefore, that very first statement, which, whether it is done by because of a lack of understanding of the operation of the regulations, or it is designed to reduce the perceived impacts of this particular scheme, should colour your view as to the any assertions which are made on behalf of the LUC.
Okay, well, if I can also add to that, because it appears to me that the policies, the plan itself, contemplates, if we look at the policies for the garden communities themselves, they refer to the number of dwellings proposed within the plan period, but they also say as part of a total, which is clearly the total that will be built beyond the plan period. So it seems to me that in approving those policies, if I were to find them sound, I would be endorsing policies that contemplate development of the whole garden communities, not just those within the plan period. And it seems to me, and you know, unless someone can provide a good argument or good evidence to the contrary, that that means that the HRA must take on board and take account of the full extent of development. Now, can we nail that point first? Is that accepted not just by LUC, which it appears to be, but also by the North Essex authorities?
So the authorities' position, I set out in this hearing statement, consistent with Natural England's position, is that, strictly speaking, that isn't required, and that's because the post-plan period development, the effects of those won't occur until post-plan, and it is right that the policies refer to the larger development within the policies. It refers to it as being an expectation. But the key point here is that a matter of practice, because the LUC and the authorities recognised the ambiguity, and I concur with Dr. Gibson, as far as I'm aware, there's no court authority on this specific point. But because the authorities are aware of the potential argument, it should take account of that. It has taken account of that. And that's the key issue in my submission, that the question, as a matter of fact, has the HRA taken account of that post-plan development? And we say it has.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, I think we know where we stand on that, Dr. Gibson. Do you want to move on to your next point?
Thank you. Yes, sir. So moving on to your questions A and B, particularly A, I'm mindful of the assertions of LUC and the authorities that they have taken into account through the broad quantum of development beyond the plan period. Of course, the HRA is also implicit within the HRA is the consideration of the mitigation measures which are available throughout and should be available throughout. And this will touch upon a point which you're going to come on to later. But the fact that the mitigation through the RAMS, whilst maybe assured in the plan period in terms of funding and certainty, beyond the plan period, it does not appear to be.
We're going to come on to that as you note, Dr. Gibson.
Absolutely.
What I'm concerned with here is looking at the document as a whole. Has it taken account of development beyond 2033? Yes or no?
I am prepared to accept the assurance of LUC that, for example, the specific paragraphs you relate to do consider the whole plan, but only in respect of the quantum development, not in terms of the mitigation which is required and will be required beyond the plan period, which forms part of the HRA process.
Can I paraphrase you to say, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that that you accept that the impacts have been assessed, having regard to the whole development beyond plan period as well as within plan period? Your concern is to do with the mitigation measures and their effectiveness and their implementability, if that's a word.
The impacts have been assessed in terms of the non-mitigated impacts, but crucially to the HRA process, it's the mitigation which reduces those impacts to a position where they may or may not be acceptable.
Does anybody else want to come in on question A? Or indeed, sorry, yes, Mr. Green.
Thank you, sir. Yes, happy to respond to the point just made. I mean, it strikes me as odd that we would, in an HRA report, assess the impacts and then, when proposing and agreeing mitigation, suddenly reduce that impact. It's not how the system works, but I can provide examples. So, for example, again, the off-site mitigation, the loss of off-site foraging habitat is a good example, because once again, I'll reiterate that it was the entirety of the garden community that we looked at. We weren't given subdivisions, we weren't given phasing, we looked at the boundary of that garden community. So therefore, when we're proposing the mitigation, when we're making assessments about the habitat, we're looking at the entirety of it. And the mitigation proposed for that would be to ensure that there is bird survey undertaken, and if bird survey finds that there are significant, albeit highly unlikely and highly precautionary, if there were important numbers of birds upon which the SPA populations depend using this land, the measures applied would apply to the entirety of the garden community.
Okay, I don't want to get too tied up in semantics here. I don't think, and I, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Gibson, I don't think you were saying that when LUC looked at the impacts, they looked at the whole garden community build-out, and then when they looked at the mitigation, they only looked at mitigation within the planned period. I don't think you were saying that, were you? It's more a general concern you have about the effectiveness of the mitigation measures per se.
I have concerns about the mitigation measures, as you're fully aware from the previous hearing.
Yeah.
But it's the certainty, which is obviously the key test in law, that those mitigation measures, which if the full build-out is considered as an impact, the certainty that those mitigation measures in the post-plan period will be fully funded, delivered. Whether or not they'll be effective is an entirely separate matter, which we have discussed in the past, whether they will be delivered in that post-plan period.
Thank you. Yeah. And you'll have noted that my original questions 5 and 6 made that distinction between the effectiveness of the measures themselves and whether they can be enshrined in policy to provide the certainty that, that is required by the regulations. So we will come on to those questions in due course. I think we can dispose now of questions A and B fairly quickly. And I set out question B: if the HRI did not take full account of the implications, can this be rectified, and if so, how? Well, Mr. Green's partly answered that question insofar as the HRA can be modified. It's not set in stone at a point in time. As long as there is a valid and effective HRA at the point that the that I'm reaching my conclusions on the plan, then that is sufficient. Mr. Williams, you want to probably put that more clearly than I just have.
No, sir. I was trying to just reiterate that Dr. Green has accepted that the language of the HRA could be made more explicit. Clearly, the NEAs are the competent authorities under the Habitats regulations. And it would be sensible for the HRA to be updated, its language to be updated, to reflect actually what Mr. Green has indicated has occurred. Not that there's any further substantive assessment work needs to be done, but just to reflect more accurately what actually was assessed.
Obviously, I'll conclude whether further assessment work needs to be done, but the essential point is that it can be done, the HRA can be updated, and subject to further consultation on it, that there is a way forward if I were to find shortcomings in the HRA as it currently stands. Let's move on then, and what we're doing next under my original question 4 is looking at three specific areas of three specific categories of potential impacts of the Section 1 plan on European sites. Firstly, water use and wastewater. Secondly, powered paragliding. And thirdly, the issue of off-site habitats for protected bird species. So let's deal first then with the issue of water use and waste water. And what the HRA says on that, first of all, in the screening stage, it concludes that further assessment of the issue of impact on water use and waste water is required at appropriate assessment stage. And then moving on to do that, the appropriate assessment considers the HRA of the Section 2 plans, the integrated water management strategy, the safeguards recommended by the Environment Agency, and the willingness of the North Essex authorities to include those safeguards in the plan. And that will be the policy amendments mentioned earlier in the Statements of Common Ground. And at paragraph 6.114, the appropriate assessment concludes that these measures are sufficient to ensure that there will be no significant adverse effects on any European site as a result of changes in water quality. And I've listed there the amendments suggested by the North Essex authorities as a result of their discussions with Anglian Water and the Environment Agency on this issue. And can I check that is a full list of the relevant amendments? Is there anything I've missed there?
Yes, the amendments in the Statement of Common Ground, SCG-002A, they are the full extent of the modifications agreed between the NEA's Environment Agency and Anglian Water.
Lovely, thank you. Right, so then the question is whether those policy changes are sufficient to ensure that there will be no significant adverse effects on any European site as a result of changes in water quality. And if not, because we'll take these two questions together, if not, what additional safeguards could be provided and would they be sufficient? Does anyone want to... I think CAWS had things to say about water quality and water use. Would you like to come in on this, Ms. Pearson?
Yeah. I am worried about the conclusion that there won't be any effect on the water quality of the Ramsar site. And very briefly, that's because, unless I've missed it, I can't find base level data for the River Cone at the moment. I have found a report that was sent by Professor Underwood, who's a marine biologist at Essex University, which finds that the river is not meeting WFD requirements at the moment and it's hyper-nutrified. So if that is the base at the moment, then we need to be working from that. Surely that should be rectified before we then create additional pressures. Professor Underwood identified that the three major pressures for the future for the EU sites in the Cone are climate change, which results in drier summers and wetter winters, which we're already seeing, extra development and agricultural runoff. So what we see as a situation is that the base level is bad, and I have been digging around in the evidence base. I've sent some emails to Anglian Water, and I've been unable to find out whether it is possible to increase the capacity of the Colchester Waste Recycling Centre to take the sewage from two new towns, Tendring, Colchester Borders Garden Community and West Tay, and the relevant Section 2 growth. It's currently struggling with capacity, and we know already there are a number of combined sewer overflows, and we know that that's what the water industry does. If it's got pressure on infrastructure, it releases untreated sewage. So clearly that has an issue on the water quality in the estuary. So with that in mind, we don't know what it will cost, whether the treatment plant can be expanded, whether the water can be treated to the highest standards required for EU sites, which is a much higher standard. And we know already from Professor Underwood's report that there are issues with pollution near the treatment plant at certain periods. And we know that the drier weather creates concentration problems and that the wetter weather that we're seeing creates greater runoff problems. So there's a kind of perfect storm of issues, and I have no confidence from anything I've read that any of this has actually been addressed. So I conclude that we cannot be certain about water quality in the future with the Section 1 plan. Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to raise issues that I will then ask the relevant authorities to deal with, the agencies and to deal with?
Actually, sorry.
Okay. Yes, carry on.
One more thing. On the proposed amendments, I don't believe they give any certainty because they're nice policy statements, but with the lack of evidence to back up delivery of those statements, we don't know what will happen. It says, for example, where necessary, improvements to water infrastructure, wastewater treatment, off-site drainage should be made, but it doesn't tell you what where necessary actually means. So my idea and the wildlife's idea and the EU legislation's idea of where necessary might be very different from the authorities' idea. Mm-hmm. So I won't go through each of the amendments, but I believe they're too woolly and there's no certainty to any of them.
Perhaps I could ask Mr. Patience to come in next to address some of those points, then I'll come to Ms. Neil.
I think we've as was said, we've agreed a statement of common ground with the North Essex authorities. In terms of the policy wording, the reason we're content with the policy wording is that it sets out that applicants would have to demonstrate that there is capacity available prior to occupational development at the receiving water recycling centre. Now, if there was a capacity available at the receiving water recycling centre for that development, then actually it wouldn't lead to deterioration of water quality on the basis that the actual permit issued by the EA its purpose fundamentally is to ensure water quality is not affected as a result of. In other words, if it is not exceeded, then water quality deterioration should not occur. Anglian Water, as the statutory sewage undertaker, has a legal obligation to provide sewage treatment capacity for all sites which have gained the planning permission, and has an investment planning process by which we identify where we consider there is a need for investment to avoid a situation where a site becomes not flow compliant. In other words, it would exceed the available capacity based upon the scale and time of growth anticipated. We have an established business plan process, as I say, and in addition, in terms of the wastewater infrastructure, we have published the year before last our water recycling long-term plan, which sets out a long-term strategy for water recycling, including in terms of water recycling capacity. And effectively, I suppose where we're coming from is the policy wording specifies that capacity has to be available before permission can be granted, and in addition, we have a legal obligation to provide and actually ensure that capacity is available in time to serve development. And secondly, we are planning through a business planning process to ensure that actually that doesn't come to pass. That is, in essence, what our process are intending to do, and it's for that reason that we've agreed the statement of common ground with the North Essex authorities.
Thank you for that. Can we look at the specific policy wording then? Could the NEAs, or indeed Mr. Patience, please identify the specific policy wording that we're concerned with here? This will be in the Statement of Common Ground 002A, won't it? Which item in that,
if I may,
statement is it we're looking at?
I believe in the Statement of Common Ground, the specific wording we're talking about is the wording relating to the supporting text for policy SP5, which I think is modification reference 56.
Right.
And then actually also SP5 itself, which is modification 62.
Yeah.
And then again, you then have some of the wording which appears in the policies for the individual sites, which I believe is modification number 75, which applies to policies SP 7, 8, 9 and 10, if that helps.
Thank you very much, as it does, yeah. Okay, so let's look at 62 then. Proposed modification to policy SP5. SP5 is a policy on infrastructure. So the proposal is to amend the policy to read the relevant part of the policy to read as follows. The authority will work with relevant providers to ensure that there is sufficient capacity in the water supply and wastewater infrastructure to respond to new development. Full stop. Where necessary, improvements to water infrastructure, wastewater treatment and off-site drainage should be made ahead of the occupation of dwellings in accordance with environmental legislation. Now, I mean, the wording there may need to be tidied up a bit, but the essential thrust of that policy is that the necessary wastewater treatment and off-site drainage has to be provided ahead of the occupation of dwellings. So not before planning permission is granted, but before the dwellings are occupied. That's right, isn't it? And I think, am I right in saying that the timing relating to ahead of the occupation of dwellings rather than before planning permission, that timing was a requirement of, or a suggestion by Anglian Water, or is that not correct?
I believe it was joint. It was actually the original source.
Can you speak into your microphone?
Oh, sorry, I do apologise. I believe, sir, that actual, although it's agreed, it's set out in the statement of common ground, the original suggestion came from the EA rather than ourselves.
Right, okay. Yeah. Is that right? Can I ask you, Ms. Neil? Do you know that whether that's right?
Yes, I assume so. We wanted the no occupation of dwellings clause in there just to ensure that level of environmental protection was available.
Right. Okay. So as far as the Environment Agency, it was clearly, you know, you're the ones with the responsibility for protecting the environmental quality of water bodies, aren't you? As far as you're concerned, that policy is sufficient to protect the River Colne and other relevant water bodies that fall within the European sites definition from adverse impacts that would contravene the habitats regulations.
Yeah, I would say so. I think just to touch on what clauses have said in their statement, that we've got to remember that the local plan is that high-level strategic document, and then that individual detail will come at later stages of planning in terms of every development will have to undertake an assessment of capacity and availability and have individual drainage plans. So that will be assessed. It's just why it's not touched on in this higher level document, as this forms the strategic legislative overview.
What I'm wondering about this, Ms. Pearson, before you come back in, is whether the issues you're raising are actually more relevant to the sustainability appraisal discussion than they are to this discussion, because what we're talking about here is quite a narrow point, really. It's about whether the safeguards are in place at the point in time that they're needed to defend the water quality against the adverse impacts from development, and I think it seems to me that the policy, as I say, there may well need to be some tightening up of the wording there. But the policy to me reads quite a familiar way to policy that I'd expect to see to deal with this particular point, taking on board the way that Anglian Water, in this case, the way that water authorities, water companies deal with the provision of sewerage infrastructure and so on, and the point in time which that occurs. And I think you're raising some relevant points. But I think they're more to do with, is the plan justified over the long term? Is there evidence to support, to demonstrate that that the plan will work, rather than Are there policies in place that will, as a last resort, defend the water quality in the way that it needs to do? So just to say that, is there anything else you want to say? Following on from what's been said there.
I'm very happy to defer it to the SADA. All I would say is that I think it's a unique plan. It's not assessing lots of small sites of, say, 100 up to 500 houses that you could maybe mitigate the problems. It's three new towns, two of which directly pump their sewage into the Cone. So I would question whether the plan could be found sound if the authorities cannot demonstrate that the sewage from those two new towns can't be properly dealt with. And then it may be a different place to discuss it, but there are assumptions within the IWMS which I think are flawed, and therefore the volume of water that's being dealt with, I think, has been underestimated. So if they don't know how much water is coming through, and I think they've got that wrong, then they don't even know what they've got to deal with, and therefore what the effect will be.
As I say, it seems to me that those are valid points, and that they're points probably better discussed at the, not just the SA actually, but also the session on infrastructure, which we're having on Thursday, where there is a specific set of questions, I think, on water provision for water supply and drainage. So on that note, anything else anybody wishes to say on those questions relating to water use and water quality? If not, can we move on to the powered paragliding next subheading? By way of introduction to that, I've said on the agenda that Natural England and the North Essex authorities consider that the measures included in the RAMS, I'll read that out in full once, and then we'll call it the RAMS after that. So this is the Essex Coast Recreational Disturbance Avoidance and Mitigation Strategy, RAMS for short, Habitats Regulations Assessment Strategy Document 2018 to 2038. And it was published in January 2019. So, as I say, Natural England and the NEAs consider that the measures included in the RAMS are sufficient to deal with the implications of powered paragliding and other potentially disturbing activities for European sites. The measures include codes of conduct for water sports, bait digging, paramotors and power hang gliders and kayakers, and the deployment of rangers to educate and communicate with individuals who are not adhering to the codes. At paragraph 1.4.8 of their further hearing statement, the authorities refer to penalties and enforcement linked to the code of conduct. So what I want to discuss on this point is whether those measures... Well, I know that some people consider those measures not sufficient. So what additional measures... if those measures are not sufficient, what additional measures ought to be put in place to ensure there's no adverse impact on European sites from these activities, specifically the powered paragliding. And then a specific question I've got, which I think perhaps we'll deal with first, question F. This reference to penalties and enforcement. What powers would the rangers actually have in that respect? It was mentioned in the authority statement, but it's not made clear what they could do. What can they do? Can they fine people? Can they arrest them? What policy? What powers do they have?
Okay. Well, I will answer that question, but I would like to begin by saying that the key objective of the Essex Coast RAMS isn't to rely on penalties and enforcement. Rather, it's to educate and encourage visitors to respect the European sites. It's primarily aimed at the majority of a population or demographic. A key role of the rangers and the water rangers is to encourage responsible recreation and educate them. As explained in paragraph 1.4.10 of our hearing statement, most forms of disturbance are likely to be a result of ignorance rather than malice. However, potential penalties and powers of enforcement do exist. Maldon District Council have a water bailiff. As far as I'm aware, that's the only tidal water bailiff post in the country. It's anticipated that the Essex Coast Rams Rangers would follow Maldon District Council's model, and Maldon's countryside and coast manager has been involved and provided advice as part of the preparation of the Essex Coast Rams strategy document. So Maldon's water bailiff's powers of enforcement are based on bylaws created within the River Blackwater and the River Colne. Maldon's coastal team have identified that the bylaws they use, which came into force in the year 2000, have perhaps become a bit out of date, and they'd like to review those to reflect current usage of the river. We think that the Essex Coast Rams is an opportunity to provide this update and to extend the good work that Maldon District Council's water bailiff has done.
Do you know any more about the bylaws? What happens if people contravene them, for example?
If people contravene them, it can go to the Magistrates Court. And I am aware Maldon District Council have informed me that they've had a 100% success rate for each of the prosecutions they've brought forward since 2000.
Yes, thank you, sir. Just to touch on the specific point of powered paragliding and other highly specialist activities, I think it's important here that we just need to put this situation into perspective. How much of the population are likely to partake in powered paragliding? I would think a tiny percentage. And actually, even with the relatively large growth that's planned, I can't imagine the numbers significantly increasing. And then you put that into the context of the fact that it's already happening. There's a club, as I understand, on Mersey, and that's happening at the moment without the benefit of the rams, without the benefit of the water and land rangers. So my view would be that actually the garden community's contribution to increasing these activities is likely to be negligible, and within any case, the measures that will be included within the rams would be more than sufficient to mitigate and avoid them. And in fact, I would argue that it would have a benefit, because it's building on measures that are currently being rolled out by Natural England of talking to these clubs and trying to get them to coordinate amongst themselves a code of conduct. So I think it would be a benefit. Thank you.
Let's hear from Dr. Gibson first, and then Ms. Luxford-Vaughan. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Just a comment on this is Ms. Blackaby was correct in saying that the most frequent form of disturbance comes from people on the ground or on the water. In actual fact, that is true, but the most damaging and disturbing activities come from those on the air, in the air, or a very loud water-based activities such as jet skiing. So it's not simply a question of numbers. I recognise what Dr. Green says, that there will be relatively few inhabitants of the new communities who indulge in these activities, but those relatively few could have disproportionately adverse effects. I recognise that the RAMS is based upon very soft measures of education rather than enforcement, and Natural England, for example, is talking with the clubs, but of course power gliders, but particularly are not reliant on club infrastructure. And they are already an issue around the coast, and it is our view that this will only get worse, and it will not be an activity which is readily controllable through the soft measures available through the RAMS. The one can, as I've always argued, RAMS can work if it's fully enforced and funded in respect of those activities where the rangers, the land and water-based rangers, can interact with those users. There will not be a similar range of rangers available to deal with the aerial onslaught.
Ms. Luxford-Vaughan.
Thank you, sir. I was going to say much the same as Dr. Gibson, but just to ask a question, really, of the 100% cases that have been successful, how many of those were reported via rangers and how many came from members of the public? Certainly we have a massive problem come the summer with jet skis, and it nearly always is a member of the public that has a decent camera makes the report. So I wonder, you know, are those rangers, are there enough of them, and where are they working? Because possibly they don't want to be working on that day when everybody is actually out.
Anybody else to my right who wishes to come in on this one? Dr. Gibson again, please.
Thank you, sir. If I may just add one further point, in specific respect of the paragliding, I believe that because this is an issue, I think this has led to the underestimation of the zones of influence affecting the Essex coast. They are coming from a wider range than the zones of influence on which the whole RAMS is predicated.
Mr. Green, you'd like to respond to those points, I take it?
Yes, thank you, sir. I'll deal with Dr. Gibson's last point first there about the zones of influence, and again I would emphasise that zones of influence aren't based on anyone that's ever visited the Essex coast. It's based on the majority of activities, and I think I should probably just leave that there. And then with regard to the other point about there not being enough rangers, that's exactly the point, that there aren't currently enough rangers, and what the RAMS will provide is something that is not currently there.
Well, I think Dr. Gibson was saying it a bit more than that, really. He was saying that the rangers won't be airborne, will they? They'll be, they can interact with people on the ground and they can interact with people on the water, but they can only interact with people in the sky when they're not in the sky. If you see what I mean, it's via clubs and so on.
Yeah, I recognise that, and I would emphasise that you will have clubs. There are particular points where people launch and land. So these are activities that are, people aren't doing it out of their back gardens. These are activities that can be understood. Rangers can get out and talk to these people. There are websites, there are clubs. This is a type of community where it's not widely encompassing. This is a very specialist activity. And again, I would go back to genuinely how many of the increase of people are going to partake in this activity.
Sir, can I just add to that, please?
Sure.
Two points I'd like to make. The first, if I can refer you to Natural England's further written statement, in paragraph 3.5 of that, they refer... Oh, sorry. Yes, so Natural England refer to powered paragliding as a niche activity and say, indeed, could have a very large zone of influence. This could more appropriately be viewed as a wider tourism issue, more so than a residential housing growth issue. And the Essex Coast RAMS exists to mitigate likely significant effects from recreational development, not tourist development.
Is that a legal point then? Is that saying that's something we needn't take into account in the HRA because it doesn't stem directly from the proposals in the Section 1 plan? Is that the point that's being made there?
Yes.
And sir, just to support that point, if I may, sorry to jump in there, the point that Mr. Green made was the fact that the zones of influence weren't based on anybody who'd ever visited. And you'll have read the RAMS document, sir, and considered the bases for the zones of influence. And it was a 75th percentile, if I remember correctly, that it was used from, because it was intended to capture recreational disturbance effects from housing in the area, not more broad tourism related activities.
Thank you, sir. I would challenge that particular point, as raised by Natural England and presented across the table there. Somebody who wants to use a power glider and they're based at one of the garden village developments further away from the coast than the Colchester Tendring borders, for example, to say that is a tourism issue rather than a housing issue, I think is missing the point substantially. That I think there is a strong risk that housing more distant from the coast, housing growth more distant from the coast, will lead to an increased incursion to the coast. Whether it's of a tourist nature or a housing nature is a moot point, and it actually irrelevant.
It is relevant, isn't it, insofar as to come within the ambit of the HRA, the impact has to be the result of development proposed within the plan, not something else that's nothing to do with the plan.
Absolutely, I agree there, sir, but I don't believe you could rule out the fact that there will be people from the more distant garden villages who will be wishing to exercise their recreational activity rights, as they see, across the in the air.
Yeah. Okay. And your point is that they're not captured by the zones of influence adopted by LUC.
Precisely so.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I'll ask LUC or the NEAs to respond to that specific point, and then I think probably we'll move on because I think we've covered everything that we need to hear on that.
Thank you, sir. I mean, what I would emphasise is that this is, again, it's the Essex authorities that are undertaking the RAMS. The zone of influence extends right along the Essex coastline. So I think it does take into account those wider people. And in any case, the measures that are being provided by the RAMS would address the low level of people travelling from further afield outside the zone of influence. I think the whole purpose of the RAMS is that, you know, it recognises that there will be recreational visits, tourism visits, other visits from outside the zone of influence.
Just before we move on, can I ask a bit more, if you know, I mean, you may not know the answers, and if you don't, then just say so, but the bylaws that the Maldon bailiff relies on, are they specific to Maldon, the Maldon District Council area? Do you know?
They apply to the River Blackwater and the River Colne, so they apply to Maldon District Council and also Colchester Borough Council.
Right.
And Maldon enforce on behalf of Colchester Borough Council.
I see. And what do you know what the bylaws, in essence, what activities do they, what do they aim to stop people doing? If you can answer that briefly. Or would it be simpler to just provide me with a copy of the bylaws?
Sorry, I knew I had it written down. I was just going through my notes.
Good.
So there are bylaws which restrict the speed of vessels, mm-hmm. and that was made under the Public Health Act, and that was in relation to the safety of swimmers.
Right.
There's also a bylaw that protects the salt marsh, and there are other bylaws in place.
Sorry, how does it protect the salt marsh? Stopping people going onto it, or?
Yes, stopping people disturbing the salt marsh.
Yeah.
And then there are other bylaws which are more location-specific. Mm-hmm. They're enforced from time to time, and the examples that I have are restricting vehicles on beaches, restricting bait digging, and there's even one for the restriction of hooved animals on an area of beach.
Yes, so Professor Black.
Could I just check? You were talking about speed limits on the River Colne. Are these reliant on Maldon's bylaws? One of the main problems is speeding, which disturbs the birds' feeding grounds. And the river police, of whom I believe there are some, can impose on the spot penalties, so it would be appropriate if the rangers on their water skis could do the same.
Thank you. Right, I think it would be helpful for me to have a copy of the relevant bylaws, please, if you could sort out a copy for me when it's convenient. But I think I've heard enough on that issue now, so can we move on?
Yes, I will certainly provide that, but just so you understand the context, that it's not necessarily the specific bylaws, but they would, as Ms. Blackberry said, would be rolled out relevant to the particular protected sites in question.
Understood. Yeah, understood. Thank you. Okay, and then my third example, or third topic that I wanted to discuss under this heading would be what I've called loss of feeding grounds. I think the more technical term is off-site habitat, tendering cultures of borders, garden community for lapwings and golden plovers. They're the ones specifically mentioned identified in the HRA. And as I've said, additional wording is proposed to certain policies to deal with that potential impact. And the questions I've set out there, I think fairly self-explanatory, are those measures adequate? If not, are there any additional measures required? And should the requirements apply to other garden communities as well as tendering Colchester borders? I think that stems from a point made by Cause, doesn't it? That in your view, there might be a case for looking at the Colchester Braintree Borders Garden Community in this light as well.
Yeah, it was as much a personal observation that even as far inland as I live, by Coggeshall, we regularly see this season have been around 200 geese on the farmland. Obviously, there's regular lapwings, so gulls and so on. So, and I had some information yesterday from someone who's got an Essex Wildlife Trust survey of the West Tay area, and again, there's regular sightings and reportings of coastal birds. So it was an observation, really, whether that has been taken into account and whether it should be further inland. Thank you.
Anybody else on this side of the table who wants to talk about off-site habitat? Yeah. Professor Black.
One of the things that surprised me is it's not proposed to do the survey of bird feeding at the Tendring Colchester Water site until after it's been agreed that there should be a garden community there. So I'd have thought this would be something which should be conducted before the decision was taken to go forwards to build at that location. And I don't know if it's an important problem that there are birds feeding there or not, but we should have the information in place before taking a decision. Because particularly the suggestion is that alternative sites should be provided to mitigate any loss of feeding ground, and no one has explained to me how you can create farmland as alternative feeding grounds.
Dr. Gibson?
Just to follow on by from both of my colleagues, of course, the requirement to have the knowledge of the distribution of the birds now is relevant to all the garden communities, but also not just where they are, but where they go, given that golden plover are the key species here in this the HRA consideration as one which is specifically listed under the European site features. We have no knowledge whether the golden plover which use the area around Braintree are part of the same population. So there is an evidence gap which I think is quite clear here.
Yes, thank you, sir. I think it's important to say from the outset that the loss of off-site foraging land at the garden community was considered highly precautionary, and the reason for that is because when we looked at the extent of suitable habitat within the boroughs and districts, it's vast. If I can just explain the ecology a little bit. They're valid points. And I'll come on to why I'm confident that the HRA is robust. These species, it's the SPA population of these birds that we're dealing with. Lapwing and golden plover that aren't linked to the SPA will turn up all over the country. There will be lapwings, quite understandably. I think it was Cors that talked about lapwings where the lady lives. The key here is we take the approach where you have the SPA population and then you acknowledge that these birds are travelling from the SPA to feed. They will travel large distances. But generally there's a rule that better quality habitat closer to the SPA is of a higher value for them. You also need to take into account the habitats that they're feeding upon, which is primarily short grazed pasture, arable fields, which are numerous across the authorities. And because of that, we take the view that their dependency on any one particular area inland, particularly when you're talking several kilometres away from the coast, from the SPA, is likely to be very low. Now, with the Colchester Tendring Borders garden village, what we did is we looked at the habitats present, and actually, most of the combination of field network would be considered to be of lower suitability. Now, I'm not saying that those birds won't occur on that site. What we're saying is it's extremely unlikely that the SPA populations, and that's what we're concerned with, the SPA populations, would be dependent upon that land. Now, it's also worth pointing out that the additional wording is not there to ensure that there won't be a result of no loss of off-site habitat. but rather to ensure that the extent of habitat that is important in maintaining the SPA populations is not reduced or degraded. Now, when we factor in that these aren't lowland heathlands, they're not ancient woodlands, they're habitats that are very, very easy to replicate, but not only to replicate and recreate, they're habitats that can be enhanced very, very easily for these species. And RSPB, the Wildlife Trust, Natural England have documents in place as to how land can be managed to maximise benefit for overwintering lapwing and golden plover. So when we've taken the approach of, I think one of the comments was, why haven't we done surveys now? Why is it sufficient to leave it to the latter stages? It's simply because there's certainty that the approach will work. If, in the unlikely event that significant numbers, i.e. greater than 1% of the SPA population of these species, were regularly reliant upon the garden community for off-site foraging, that would then trigger the need for mitigation. And mitigation could be provided either within the garden communities, because they're vast, or within a zone of influence for these species, which is also vast because they travel a long distance from the SPA. But obviously it would be favourable to target such mitigatory enhancements to be closer to the SPA. And it would essentially be land management practices to ensure that it's optimal for the species.
Thank you. Can we look at the specific policy wording? We're looking at a statement of common ground, are we? Or is it? Sorry, is it? Well, actually, what I've identified there is EB91, didn't I? So perhaps that's the best place to look. EB91A. So we've got the change to policy SP8, which is the specific policy for tendering cultured borders garden community. Paragraph F20, and the relevant paragraph is as follows: wintering bird surveys will be undertaken at the appropriate time of year as part of the DPD preparation to identify any off-site functional habitat. Should any be identified, development must firstly avoid impacts. Where this is not possible, it must be phased to deliver habitat creation and management, either on or off-site, to mitigate any significant impacts. So the timing of the surveys would be during the preparation of the DPD, the next site-specific local plan for tendering cultures to borders, to identify, as you've explained, Mr. Green, to identify any habitat that's being used by the SPA birds. And then it goes on to say, firstly, avoid impacts, which I take to mean the ideal situation is you don't build on the ground that the birds are using, the birds are feeding on. If that's not possible, then you, through site management, you provide you retain or provide alternative habitat on site or elsewhere to compensate for any loss of direct loss of habitat on the site itself. So that's what that policy is saying. Yes, and then there's something else in policy SP1B. Yeah, it's the third paragraph in reference 14, isn't it? To mitigate for the loss of off-site habitat, the appropriate assessment identified the need for wintering bird surveys for the tendering culture to border garden communities as part of any project level development proposals and master planning. Well, that rather understates what it said, actually, doesn't it? So that probably needs beefing up a bit to explain exactly what it says. Because it doesn't just say surveys, does it? It says act on the surveys if they find that that action is needed. But the key policy is the key policy text is in SP8, relating specifically to tendering cultures to borders, and you've explained why you think that's the right place to focus that policy requirement. Right. Anything else anybody wants to say on issue C? If there isn't, I think that's probably a good time to take a mid-morning break. It's nearly 10 past 11. Can we come back at 25 past, please? Thank you.
Please hold. Your meeting has been temporarily adjourned. Please hold. Your meeting has been temporarily adjourned. Please hold, 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 your meeting has been temporarily adjourned. Please hold. 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 Your meeting has been temporarily adjourned. Please hold, 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 your meeting has been temporarily adjourned.
So we're moving on now to my original question 5 on the agenda. Would implementation of the mitigation measures proposed in the Habitats regulations, sorry, in the RAMS document, ensure that the Section 1 plan, either alone or in combination with other plans and projects, would not adversely affect the integrity of any European site, that being the legal test set in the Habitats regulations. I think I'm going to ask Dr. Gibson, having said many times that I don't want to hear what you've put in your submissions, I think it would be helpful at this point if you could briefly summarise, Dr. Gibson, because I think you're the one who's raised the most pertinent concerns about the effectiveness of the RAMS document. I wonder if would you be able to summarise briefly what your concerns are about its likely effectiveness?
Indeed, sir. Thank you. I've had a long involvement in this sort of approach of managing recreational impacts, going back into my time working with Natural England. And indeed, I was working 10 years ago on some of the very earliest RAMS-type schemes, particularly as a senior senior advisor to those being developed in Breckland and Solent. To give you a little bit of background as to where they came from, obviously there's always been an issue about housing shortages, new houses required, and around 2010, which is a very very significant date, a lot of schemes started to come forward. One of those, many of those involving large housing close to wildlife sites. Now, at that time, Natural England, until that time, Natural England had a remit which was to be the independent watchdog for wildlife in the UK and in England. But when the coalition government came into force, one of their first decisions was to tell us we were no longer independent and had to deliver government policy and growth. At that point, we then started to have to explore alternative approaches to those we may have previously taken in response to developments of this nature. We were told to say yes if rather than no. And that really is the fundament of how the RAMS types approaches came to being. We started to evolve RAMS types approaches as the yes if approach, if mitigation can be delivered and ensured in perpetuity, then impacts can be offset. The implicit in all of those early developments was the fact that a key part of that would be the review of the effectiveness of those schemes, and that's obviously the reviews have partially been undertaken, but there's been very little evidence actually come forward as to the precise success, the actual success of mitigating recreational pressures arising from these developments as a result of the deployment of RAMS schemes. The uncertainty for me, and it is certainty which is required in terms of the habitats regulations, the competent authority must be able to ascertain that there will be no adverse effects on the integrity of the European site. So the lack of certainty arises from the untried, or now tried, but largely untested nature of RAMS schemes in terms of overall benefits or the overall fulfilment of mitigation objectives. In terms of this RAMS scheme, one point I would make about the RAMS, this particular RAMS scheme that I think is you may be slightly misled earlier on when Dr. Green mentioned that this RAMS scheme is endorsed by Natural England and the RSPB. It's my understanding that the RSPB has not endorsed this particular scheme. Whilst it may endorse the approach nationally, it hasn't actually endorsed this scheme. The concerns are around the fact that whilst all of the various components of a RAMS scheme, in theory, may work, it's whether they will work, whether the soft approaches, the educational approaches will work, whether the enforcement approaches will be there and sufficient and available, whether the funding required to deliver those RAMS schemes in perpetuity can be relied upon. All of those say to me that something of this nature, whilst it is possible, if it were fully deployed and all of its aspects worked, and all of those aspects worked without hindrance into the future, then it may be possible to offset the harm associated with a scheme such as this. because we have no empirical evidence that they can work, that is, I would argue that actually it's unsafe to rely upon RAM scheme after RAM scheme after RAM scheme without empirical evidence of success, because we are simply creating a problem for the future which may lead to serious degradation of our natural capital.
Okay, thanks. The point you make about the review mechanisms in the other RAM schemes and the lack of evidence that they have provided of their success, do you think that's just why is that? Is that because the review mechanisms are not adequate, or is it just because there hasn't been enough time to see whether they've worked? Why isn't there the evidence?
I think it's a question of time primarily. The fact that to get the time course of the development of the development and the development of the RAM scheme and the deployment of the RAM scheme and evaluation of its benefits is a long-term process. And this is recognised, I believe, Natural England in their statement referred to footprint ecology reviewing the an organisation who I respect immensely, reviewing the Solent scheme. And they made very similar points about time, time taken to demonstrate such schemes are successful. Their statement within Natural England's statement is hardly a ringing endorsement of the success of the schemes. So we are in a situation now where we have a lot of these sorts of schemes being deployed. Those where there are good evidence of success, better evidence of success, include such as the Thames Basin Heaths, which are a very different scenario to the one we are dealing with here, as you are well aware, much more reliant upon sustainable alternative green space as well as warning management RAMS approaches. Here we are dealing with purely RAMS, and where that RAMS is reliant upon such soft measures as advice, guidance, persuasion, it's perhaps not surprising that I believe that I've got concerns that we will be not in a position where we can demonstrate success of this. Other schemes are looking at it, but none has yet come up with evidence because of the time lag. If in the interim of this time lag we continue to support further developments which will have these impacts, we are, as I say, creating a perfect storm for the future, in my view.
What do you think about the review mechanisms in the RAMS itself, the Essex Coast RAMS?
I believe the mechanisms are there, yes. I would say that I do not disagree with the RAMS, that it may work. But as I've always said, it may work to... But at this stage, may does not ensure, it does not allow you to ascertain that it will work. If all of the mitigation measures were deployed everywhere, all the time, robustly, in perpetuity, be reviewed through the review mechanisms in the RAM, implicit in the scheme, they may be successful in mitigation, but I don't believe there is sufficient certainty to be able to say it will, and therefore that it can be ascertained that it will not have an adverse effect upon the integrity of the European sites.
Thank you. Mr. Williams, you've got your board up.
Thank you, sir. I will ask, it's Mr. Green, my fault, not Dr. Green, and Ms. Blackby, to respond to the detail. But I think here, the gentleman has just identified, crystallised the difference between the parties. His view is the RAMs may work. That of the competent authorities and of Natural England is that there is sufficient certainty it will work. Mm-hmm. And before I ask Mr. Green to outline why we are of that view, I'd like to address you very briefly on the level of certainty. So this is a question mm-hmm. Lord Chandra, and yep. there's three points I'd like to make. Mm-hmm. The first is that the question is whether the competent authorities can be certain it will not adversely affect the integrity of that site. But, as the Wadden, and that's from the Waddenzee case, but as the Waddenzee case tells us, that means where there is no reasonable doubt about the absence of such effects. So it tempers, Waddenzee itself tempers the level of certainty. That was confirmed in the Supreme Court in the Champion case, where the Lord Carnworth indicated that absolute certainty was not required. So that's the first point. The second point, again from Champion, and, but also other authorities, is that when coming to the conclusion on certainty, the competent authorities will have to reach a judgment. And they can reach a judgment that there will be, that there is sufficient certainty there will be no adverse effects, even though that can't be demonstrated from an objective viewpoint. And that, again, is a Champion and also a case of Smith in the Court of Appeal. So that's the second point. And then the third point is that the competent authorities are required to give considerable weight to the views of the appropriate nature conservation body. That's the numerous cases, including Purdue here, Natural England. And Natural England have made their views very plain, and more than that, have been an integral part of the, an instigator of the RAMS process. And whilst that's not determinative, the competent authorities would need to have cogent reasons for disagreeing with Natural England, and we say we don't have those cogent reasons, quite the contrary, we support their view. And it's on that basis I turn to Mr. Green to explain why the competent authorities are sufficiently certain, to the requisite degree of certainty, that RAMS will be effective.
Yes, thank you. I mean, firstly, I should point out that I have a lot of respect for the work that Dr. Gibson has done in his career in informing these studies and this RAMS approach as part of his work with Natural England. I would also agree that there is no study, no package anywhere that says, yes, RAMS works, because, as Dr. Gibson pointed out, it is a relatively new approach and there's a time lag. But what I would say is we need to go back to the basis on which Natural England originally initiated this approach. Dr. Gibson referred to the 2010 turning point. I think the key here is that as a package, it's new. RAMS is new. But what it's based on is not. The constituent measures are not new, and that is an understanding of the birds involved, an understanding of their ecology, an understanding of the types of impacts that most affect them, and also management of people. There's a wealth of evidence around the UK as to, you know, particularly on things like flagship nature reserve sites. The RSPB do it, Natural England do it, Wildlife Trusts do it, about how people can be managed. There's a wealth of studies also, again, coming back to this, that it's less about numbers, and again, Dr. Gibson pointed to this earlier, about the RAMS being less about numbers. It's less about numbers and more about having the measures in place. Studies show that, And this is fairly applicable across the UK, depending on whatever habitat you may be in, that a low number of people that are unmanaged and unregulated can cause far more destruction and impact on sensitive wildlife, particularly birds, than a much higher number of people that are managed. And that's demonstrated in management examples across the UK, which we'd happily provide. And secondly, I would emphasise that this approach has been accepted elsewhere by inspectors, applying the same test under the HABs regs. We've got examples here. I recently worked on the New Forest District hearing. There's the local plan there. There's Breckland District Council, Gravesham Core Strategy, Plymouth. I can provide lots of examples. North East Lincolnshire local plan, where very similar strategic mitigation schemes have been relied upon and accepted by the planning inspectorate. And finally, those charged with protection of the habitats, particularly Natural England, but I would also point to RSPB and the Wildlife Trust. And I'll caveat this in line with Dr. Gibson's point that he made. These are the bodies that are initiating this work. It's Natural England's baby. They're the ones that have pushed this UK-wide. It's supported in locations by RSPB and Wildlife Trust, depending on their particular views on the ground. And it does differ. They don't just have the RSPB and the Wildlife Trust don't just have a view of, yes, rams work. They're very particular about where and how they can work. And my point earlier, I was clearly not clear. It wasn't to say that the RSPB specifically have endorsed this rams, although there have been discussions with them and they would like to be on the partnership board, and I see no reason why they wouldn't be part of the partnership, as they do in other locations. So, for example, the Solent Aware Bird Aware Scheme on the south coast. So those are my three points, really, that this isn't new, that it's been accepted in local plan several times, and that those experts, the people that really know what they're talking about when it comes to management of recreation, endorse this approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything more from the authorities' side anything more on the authorities' side from?
Are you turning to your specific questions now under this heading? Are you happy that you've heard?
I will in a minute. Yeah, I just want to make sure there's nothing more on that. On that particular point, Dr. Gibson, you want to come back?
Thank you, sir. Yes, just to make it clear, I do not disagree with a lot of what Mr. Green says. For example, around the low number, the number if side of things, the low number high impact as opposed to high impact. High number, low impact, if you have the appropriate regulation. This is absolutely clear from somewhere like Minsmere Nature Reserve, where you have many, many, many hundreds of thousands of visitors and an awful lot of wildlife. They are effectively regulated. But nobody has ever been able, as I understand it, to make that transition from a nature reserve scale to a landscape scale. And that's what we'll be seeking here, is to have the same level of regulation at a landscape scale with multiple points of access, which make it so much more difficult to deliver successfully. The fact that in several inspectors' decisions have gone in favour of delivering RAM schemes, well, I would revert to my argument there that it doesn't mean they were right. With all due respect to your colleagues, if the wrong questions were asked in terms of the Habitats Directive or the wrong level of certainty was applied, then it may not be that they were right. And then just to comment on the very useful level of proof as outlined at the start of this session, yes, I fully accept the case law indicates that you cannot have 100% certainty of proof. There was a tendency following the early decisions to try and push the level of proof down to something around the balance of probabilities as being the appropriate certainty. That is now reverted back to a higher level of proof, somewhere around beyond reasonable doubt, through case law in Europe and in the UK. And I would maintain still that it is not beyond reasonable doubt that this RAM scheme will offset the adverse effects to a level required. Thank you.
Thank you. Looking at my specific questions there, I mean, I think what we've been dealing with really has been question L, essentially revolving around what evidence is necessary to make to pass the certainty test effectively. And I think I've probably heard enough on that. So can I ask the specific question K to the authorities, if they know the answer to this? What involvement will Natural England have in the management, monitoring and review of the RAMs?
Well, as I've explained, Natural England initiated the Essex Coast RAMs and have been involved since the outset. They endorsed the RAMS strategy document before the local authority partners adopted it. They continue to have a role in the management, monitoring and review through their role on the Essex Coast RAMS steering group. So the purpose of the steering group is to manage the partnership's work and activities. Natural England will also be able to advise if recreational disturbance is increasing at particular European sites or specific locations to enable the RAMS rangers to be able to target these areas. Natural England will also advise if monitoring indicates that recreational disturbance isn't being mitigated as expected. Any issues can be reviewed and the mitigation refined or targeted as required. And I would also like to comment on the RSPB. So whilst the RSPB have not endorsed the Essex Coast RAM strategy, they have been involved in the preparation through attending workshops. And we're also involved in discussions with the RSPB about becoming a member of the Essex Coast RAM steering group. And I think it's likely that Essex Wildlife Trust will also have a role.
You think they'll both become part of the steering group?
Yes. I've personally had conversations with a representative of the RSPB about becoming a member of the steering group. And whilst I haven't had those discussions with Essex Wildlife Trust, they attended RAMS workshops, so they have been involved in the preparation of the RAMS.
Just to jump in there as well, I think it's also worth pointing out that neither of those bodies have objected. And I am familiar with objections from the RSPB. They regularly object when they think that something is wrong. So I would give great weight to the fact that they're not here and that they're not concerned and that they haven't objected.
Can I ask about the monitoring and review process, which is really moving on to my question M. So you've talked about the steering group reviewing the success of the mitigation and being able to redirect resources according to where they think they're needed to alter the specific actions being taken if there's a need to do that. What happens if you get to the point where you've tried everything you can through, you know, changing the approach and so on, redirecting resources and so on, but you can't stop the adverse effects happening? So we're talking about, you know, let's say 10 years down the line, reasonable proportion of the development at the garden community has been built out, and you're finding that despite the best efforts of the RAMS proposals, the RAMS measures, there is harm taking place. What happens then?
I mean, under the Habs regs, it's fairly clear you'd have two options. You would either not be able to develop because you wouldn't be able to rule out adverse effects on integrity, or the second option would be to go down the derogation tests where you try and you effectively, is there a satisfactory alternative? Can favourable conservation status be maintained? And you would be looking then for compensation, which is essentially accepting an adverse effect on integrity, but maintaining the favourable conservation status of the qualifying features of the European sites through compensatory habitat.
Okay. Developers will have planning permissions at that point, so you can't stop them building, can you? They've got a planning permission for 2,500, let's say, at Tendering Borders, Tendering Cultures Borders, and they've built 1,500 of them. You can't stop them building the remaining 1,000, can you?
There are legal mechanisms in which you can revoke planning permissions. But yes, once they build up, no. The point is, though, is this, in relation to the garden communities. There is going to be a number of stages where this question, is there sufficient certainty, has to be revisited.
Right. Good, thank you.
This isn't a once and for all game. You've got to be satisfied there's sufficient certainty at this stage in respect of the principle of the garden communities. We will have, at least in respect of the garden communities, the examination of the DPD, which you and, again, the authorities being the competent authorities are going to have to re-examine that question. We're then going to have the planning applications themselves, which will be subject to the Habitats Regs assessment. So prior to that plan permission being granted, there will be at least two rounds of further assessment when the same level of certainty, assuming the habitat regulations stay the same, will have to be assessed. So the question is now, do you have the requisite certainty for what you're proving now? And we say you do.
And just to add, it's worth emphasising again that the RAMS approach is iterative. It's not a case of plonking all the development in and then mitigating. This is going to evolve in line as development comes forward. So there's a feedback loop, there's monitoring. So if the monitoring findings and the research and the studies show that actually in the future we can't rule something out, there's room there for remedial measures. So the point being, the feedback loop ensures that you get the information back well in advance of adverse effects occurring.
So if I could make one final point on that. It's a temporal one about the habitats regulations. It requires competent authorities in relation to assessment of plans to be sufficiently certain as at the adoption of the plan, and for in terms of the projects, when consent is given for the projects. It doesn't require sufficient certainty to a later date when it's built out. So the habitats regs and directive could have had that requirement. They haven't done so. So the concern of whether there's sufficient certainty is only at the time when either the plan is being adopted or planning permission is being granted.
If the DPD stage is to be effective in providing another step at which the HRA mitigation measures can be tested for certainty, then it's going to be necessary for this plan not to enable a planning permission to come forward based on this plan alone, isn't it? If that's part of your position on HRA effectiveness.
That's what's envisaged for the garden communities.
Yes.
And that they will be brought forward under the DPD process. That's plain from the policies of the plan themselves, this Section 1 plan themselves. My answer to whether you can have sufficient certainty isn't dependent on there being further opportunities for this issue to be considered.
Right.
You need sufficient certainty now.
Yes,
But in terms of what will we know down the line? Will we know whether the RAM's approach will be effective or not? Will empirical evidence come forwards? There will be further opportunities where the competent authorities have to reassess that judgment and will be bound by a matter of law to do so further down the line.
Yeah. Okay, I'll hold that question for a later session then, because I think it may be more relevant in later sessions. Thank you. Okay. Right, I've got three people waiting over there. Let's go down the table. Ms. Pearson first.
Thank you, sir. What I've observed during the process of this making of the plan is that the authorities continually try and divide things into bite-sized chunks to be dealt with at a later date. And I'm very concerned that if there isn't certainty now, we end up in a situation where the habitats can't be replaced. If there is damage done, that damage can't be retrospectively sorted out. There's an example currently in the Saddlery Brook area, which is supposed to be a country park of East Colchester, where a developer's ripped out a protected hedgerow. That can't be replaced. So I'm very concerned about these EU sites. If it doesn't give the security we need now, then there is a risk to the environment later down the line.
Dr. Gibson.
Thank you, sir. Yes, the point being raised about sufficient certainty at this stage, I fully accept there are other stages where HRA is important and relevant, right down to the individual planning application stage. If the certainty at those stages is not proven and development proceeds only partially in effect, then that surely removes the whole strategic approach to the developments which are being proposed anyway, with all of the beneficial measures to the future and current inhabitants of North East Essex. Moreover, the question of, I was very, very grateful to Mr. Green for raising the derogation tests, because in my opinion, we should be not looking at those derogation tests down the line with an adverse HRA judgment. The level of certainty here already is at a stage where we should be applying those derogation tests, i.e. accepting you cannot ascertain there will be no adverse effect on integrity. That does not stop the plan from proceeding, provided the derogation tests are met. The tests around national need may well be met quite easily. The tests around alternative solutions will be rather more difficult to meet, given what it seemed quite apparent at the strategic site selection stage of the Garden Villages proposal, where opportunity was allowed to drive strategy rather than strategy determining opportunity. The sites were selected to an extent upon the availability from the landowners.
Okay, Professor Black.
If there's a possibility that permission is given for the garden communities in principle, but then further down the line it's decided they can't be fully built out because of habitat regulations problems, then this raises issues for the viability of the garden communities.
Thank you. Yep. All of which really circles back to Mr. Williams's point that the certainty test applies now and can't be sort of deferred to a later stage?
Absolutely, sir. If I could end on that point, the competent authorities are confident that the certainty test has been met, and so Natural England, we're not of the view, others may be, that we need to go into the derogation tests. We're firmly of that view.
Well, that's a matter I'll have to take away and decide for myself. Can we move on then to my original question six and the questions that that flow from that? And this is to do not with whether the RAMS proposals, the RAMS measures would work in principle and whether there's evidence to show that they would work in principle. This is moving on to look at the way that they've been incorporated into the plan and the policy mechanisms to actually implement them and whether those policy mechanisms themselves would be effective. So can I ask the authorities to deal first with my question N, the policy mechanism by which contributions to the RAMS would be secured from development at the garden communities?
Yes, the local plan includes policy SP1B, which is a specific policy relating to the Essex Coast RAMS. We have agreed a modification to that with Natural England in our Statement of Common Ground SCG001A. That modification updates the wording to say that the RAMS strategy is complete. So the RAMS strategy document has been adopted by all 12 local authority partners. Consultation on the Essex Coast RAMS SPD commenced on Friday the 10th of January for a 6 weeks period. The NEAs are all collecting the RAMS tariff from residential development within the zones of influence. And for major development, that's collected through Section 106 agreements.
Right, so it's a tariff. And it's which policy is it that asks, that says that developments have to pay the tariff?
It's policy SP1B.
I think I'm right in saying that isn't a policy in the submitted plan. Is that right?
That's correct.
A policy it's a suggested amendment, in effect,
yes.
Which the councils are proposing in order to make the plan sound.
Yes.
Yep. So where does SP1B refer to the tariff? Is it the paragraph that says contributions will be secured towards mitigation measures identified in the RAMS?
Yes, it doesn't refer to the tariff. It refers to the RAMS strategy document. It could be reworded to refer to the tariff. The tariff could possibly change over time, which was why we didn't want to include specific reference to the current tariff.
Well, how much is the tariff currently?
It's currently £122.30 per dwelling.
Now, this policy isn't adopted, so what's the policy basis for collecting the tariff currently?
The habitat regulations.
Right. Okay. I mean, it probably doesn't matter to me because I'm not looking at the, you know, what's going on currently, but I'm just interested to know. Yeah.
Okay. So there's also an interim guidance note from Natural England. Which doesn't specify the particular tariff, but does indicate that it should be collected and envisages post-RAMS world as well. And then, to be clear, the detail is left to the RAMS and the SPD because, as Blackberry suggested, that there needs to be review of the specific per dwelling requirement tariff, depending on the potential, on the eventualities that play out, and it's obviously easier to amend the SPD than a local plan, so it shouldn't be included in the local plan as a specific tariff. It's appropriate to deal with that level of detail in the SPD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
further point on that is that because we're the reason it's come forward on the SPD, and the RAMS explains this, is because we're dealing with 11 authorities that need to collect that. And so they're all at different stages in their local plan process, which is why there's a consistent SPD that's being proposed.
Mm. Okay. Are the authorities happy that the wording of policy SP1B would be sufficient to ensure that the tariff would apply to proposed development within the Section 1 plan?
Yes, we are.
Is it the intention to cascade similar policy wording down to the SPDs, or just to rely on this wording here?
I think that Natural England would want, on a precautionary basis, I think that they would want to include a policy in the DPDs.
Okay. When you say...
Natural England did comment that they were happy to see that the RAMS is referred to in a standalone policy rather than being added on to a site-specific policy.
You've talked about the tariff being reviewed, so presumably that could mean it could go up. If it was considered to be necessary, and that would be how would that be brought about if you wanted to change the figure in the tariff? Did you say a review of the SPD would be the way to do it?
So any changes to the tariff would be through a review to the RAMS strategy document.
I see.
The RAMS SPD that's currently out for consultation refers to a tariff, but it doesn't refer to the current tariff, so the SPD wouldn't have to be updated at any time that the tariff was.
Doesn't it? Paragraph 4.4. It does say it'll be reviewed periodically and republished as necessary. Mm. So. Yeah. Okay. Does anybody else want to come in on question N, the policy mechanism? No. Okay, let's move on then. My question O, is the cost of contribution to the RAMS included in the highest viability assessments of the proposed garden communities? Someone able to answer that question for me?
Yes, the highest appraisal includes a general allowance of £500 per unit under an environmental waste category. This is an overall allowance to cover a range of smaller environmental matters, and as I've mentioned, the current RAMS tariff is £122.30.
Thank you. And my question P, how will continued implementation of the measures beyond 2033 or 2038 be secured? Now those dates are significant because the end date of the plan is 2033 and the end date of the RAMS is 2038. Clearly the development proposed at the garden communities goes on well beyond those dates. So what's the mechanism for ensuring that the measures continue to be implemented beyond the date of the beyond the end date of the RAMS?
There's 2 points to make here. Firstly, the Essex Coast RAMS is designed so that measures can be sustained in perpetuity. And the second point, that monitoring and lessons learned will inform future iterations of the RAMS. So turning to the in perpetuity point, the RAMS strategy document recognises in paragraphs 7.6 and 8.11 that the mitigation measures will be implemented in perpetuity. And also, if I can refer you to paragraph 3.2 of the RAMS strategy document. The final bullet point states that the RAMS will identify how best to incorporate monitoring data and other information and best practice into future reviews of the strategy and local plans. So a percentage of contributions will need to be set aside to ensure that the RAMS measures can be implemented in perpetuity. That percentage of contributions will be determined by the project board. At the current time, the Essex Coast RAMS is in its infancy. The priority is using contributions that the 12 local authority partners are collecting to fund the appointment of a delivery officer and two rangers. The delivery officer and rangers, once in post, will implement the mitigation package. The delivery officer will recommend to the project board an appropriate percentage of contributions to put into an in-perpetuity fund based on the time frame for the delivery of the mitigation measures, forecasted contributions, and best practice from examples elsewhere. It's quite normal not to put contributions into the in-perpetuity fund initially, as getting the project started is the priority. And there are examples, including BirdAware Solent and BirdWise North Kent, who didn't put money into an in-perpetuity fund initially, but now have both set up an in-perpetuity fund.
And I'll get the second point there that was raised by Ms. Blackaby, which concerns monitoring and future RAMS. I think it's important to recognise that an important part of the RAMS process is the feedback loop. So page 65 of the RAMS sets out the monitoring steering group, how it will be fed back, how it will be reported. Essentially, it's a survey and monitoring ongoing of people and birds to determine well in advance if impacts are likely to occur in the future. And I think it's important to feed that point back to a point made earlier, which was very much yes, the RAMS will work, or no, it won't approach. And I think we need to be realistic in that this is an iterative approach, and actually it's going to evolve, and the feedback will be that some parts of the RAMS are working very well and others need to be refined. And I think we need to accept that and acknowledge that the RAMS is going to evolve, and where you get the feedback loop, the systems are in place to enable refinement of the RAMS. If that means increasing wardening in one area, reducing it, just, you know, for example. But it's not set in stone. The other points here are that the future versions of the RAMS, which will apply 2038, will be informed by the lessons learnt, as I've just touched upon. It's a legal requirement to review plans every 5 years. And finally, I think it's unreasonable to expect there to be a formalised costed strategy in place for the lifetime of the garden communities beyond 2038. And we're confident that the RAMS covers and indeed exceeds the development that will take place in the period.
Thank you. Professor Black.
At the moment, the contribution per household that you've calculated just takes the total cost up to 2038 and divides by your estimate of the number of houses. So it doesn't allow anything for a contribution to in perpetuity. So do we understand that the contribution will have to be raised in order to meet the costs? Also, the costs will... The houses will get built up to 2038 and the people will be living in them, and we'll still need to continue with the level of expenditure that's outlined per annum in the RAMS document.
Would you like to deal with those points?
So the tariff is like, well, the tariff will be reviewed. It could change in the future. I think if I refer you to the NEA's hearing statement, and in response to question three, we explain that the housing numbers in the RAMS strategy document will be reviewed and updated over the lifetime of the strategy, in accordance with local planning authority monitoring data as part of the Essex Coast RAMS monitoring and review process. And that's paragraph 1.3.4. And also paragraph 1.3.6 of our hearing statement, where we say that the Essex Coast RAMS has been designed to be flexible and respond to changes to local plans through regular monitoring and review.
The point Professor Black is making there is that if you look at page 64 of the RAMS document, table 8.3, that sets out how the contribution has been calculated. And it's the figure in the right-hand column, cost of mitigation per LPA area, that is taken directly from the figure on the previous page, page 63, which is the total of mitigation package divided pro rata to each of the authorities. So on the face of it, it seems there's no spare money for investment.
Yes, so the tariff will have to be reviewed once the project board has decided on the appropriate percentage of funds to set aside into an in-perpetuity fund. But the point I was trying to make was that there are other reasons why the tariff would be reviewed and could be changed.
So the second point, just in relation to that, is that there is some slack in what's already been costed in two ways. One, not all of the costs are incurred up front. So some of the costs are envisaged being incurred from later on in the period, years 10, 15 onwards. And therefore, there are at least the possibility of a pool of money as being available, because they wouldn't need to be spent then, but could be put in perpetuity. And secondly, there is a not unhealthy contingency provision. That's not to say that the review wouldn't need to consider whether a specific line item needs to be added in for in perpetuity funding, but that there is some slack in relation to that.
I mean, I'm aware that paragraph 811 does say a proportion of all developer contributions collected, percentage to be determined by the board, will be invested. So it does have that commitment there. It's not immediately clear where that's accounted for in the budget. And I think you've given an answer to that, tariff review and or slack in the budget. You wanted to come back in over there?
Yes, on the slack in the budget, it should also be pointed out that not all the houses are going to be built up front. So it isn't that you get all the money and you can invest some of it.
No.
So the slack point, I think, is possibly invalid.
Thank you. Dr. Gibson.
Thank you, sir. Just a brief comment about Dr. Green's last statement regarding the evolution of the RAMS and the recognition that, very pragmatic recognition, that parts of the RAMS may not work. And they will be subject then to a feedback loop of review and revision so that it will work, hopefully. Feedback loops take time to implement, and I would just point out that you, sir, need to be satisfied that in those times of a feedback loop working, the sites will not end up in an integrity deficit, which would be illegal.
Thank you. You want to respond to that, Mr. Green?
Yes, just to clarify, the point I was trying to make was that this RAM strategy, which encompasses the entirety of the Essex coastline, will have inevitably things that require refinement. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that aspects of the RAMs requiring refinement will immediately undermine the ability of the RAMs to operate as intended. I mean, we could be talking about something minimal like where bins go, or timings that need to be changed for ranger patrols. So the point I was trying to make is that feedback loop will be there to refine things, and that it's not simply a yes, the RAMs will work, no, it won't approach. It will continue to get better and stronger as it evolves.
Okay, can I turn back to the budget and the questions around that? Say for the sake of argument that I was to decide that only one of the three garden communities was shown to be sound, and only one should go forward. What effect would that have on the RAMS and its ability to be implemented? I mean, in other words, how sensitive is all this to decisions not to approve development in certain places?
Well, if one or two of the proposed garden communities were found to be sound, then allocations would be needed elsewhere.
Right.
The whole of Colchester Borough, the whole of Tendring District, a part of Braintree District, fall within the zone of influence, so those allocations would contribute.
Right. Is there anything more anybody wants to say? Any points not yet covered under this heading of Habitats Regulation Assessment? No? Good. Well, then, thank you all very much for attending. Particularly, I think Anglian Water and Environment Agency came at my specific invitation, so thank you particularly for coming along. But thank you to all of you, and that concludes this session, and I'll be here again at 2:00 for Matter 2. Thank you very much. Thank you.